So hello and good afternoon. So I'm going to say a bit more about Padmasambhava and what he really means and embodies, and also in what way is he relevant for us. So that's an important point. In what way is he relevant for us? What does he bring to us? How can he help us, so to speak? And how can we understand these teachings, this mythology that I'm talking about? What does it really mean? So I was rather imagining that there'd be, perhaps we'd be losing a few people, but we'd also be gaining a few people. And I'd be kind of re-explaining some of the things that I've already said. But in fact, that doesn't seem to be necessary, because apart from perhaps just one or two people, you're all here this morning. But anyway, I'm going to carry on regardless with my notes and just recap a little bit. But perhaps that won't be a bad thing, because so let me just centre myself and come into what I'm talking about. So I was saying this morning that Padmasambhava is a historical figure, and that historical aspect is very important, and it sits there together with the mythology that we have about Padmasambhava. So, as I said this morning, he was invited to Tibet by King Chösen Detsen in the 8th century to help establish Buddhism there. As before that, about 200 years ago, there had been attempts to establish Buddhism, but they hadn't really come to anything. And in a way, Buddhism wasn't really established till the 11th century, which was a lot later on. So it clearly wasn't easy to bring the Dharma to Tibet. It was a very wild, mountainous area. And the people there at that time, well, they didn't have any written language, they didn't have all that much culture, all that had to be brought from India. So it wasn't only about bringing the Dharma, the teaching, to Tibet. It was also about bringing, the whole great mixture and depth of Indian culture. So the king wanted to build the monastery. That's what you did in those days. You ordained monks, you translated texts. He wanted to establish a monastic tradition. They invited Shantarakshita, the scholar. But the story goes is that when they started building the monastery, there'd be a whole army of builders who would build it during the day. But then at night, something mysterious would happen. The walls would fall down. They'd find that what they'd built unbuilt. Is that deconstructed in the morning? You know, and we quite often find this as a sort of mythological motif in also various Western fairy tales. There's an attempt to do something during the day, and we bring our kind of rational, conscious intentionality during the day, but then at night something else happens, and perhaps a different part of us is there, and something else happens during the night. You know, the unconscious, so to speak, has got quite a different, I can't exactly say agenda, but quite a different orientation, really. So our conscious intention and our unconscious don't necessarily coincide. Sometimes they pull in quite different directions. So clearly that's how it was for the people building the monastery. So the indigenous Bon practitioners and teachers were very much against the introduction of a new religion, and they created a whole variety of difficulties. So this is our context. Padmasambhava is invited to Tibet. And I was thinking about this yesterday. I went out to Mitchell's Fold Stone Circle, which is not all that far from Shrewsbury. It's about 16 miles away from Shrewsbury. And I went to the Stone Circle yesterday, and I climbed up the hill, and there was a really wonderful panoramic view from the top of the hill. And I knew I was going to be giving this talk this morning. So I was thinking about stones, and I was thinking about stone circles, and I was thinking about the view that you get from the top of a hillside here in Shrewsbury. But I was also thinking just how different the countryside is here to the countryside Padmasambhava was negotiating his way through. So we have fairly modest hills here in Shropshire. We have this rolling countryside. It's very beautiful and it's very panoramic. But our story is that Padmasambhava walked all the way from Kathmandu in Nepal up to Tibet. So the Himalayan plateau is something like 18,000 feet up, 18 to 20,000 feet up. So that's just the level of the plateau. And then, of course, you've got 26,000, 27,000, 28,000 feet peaks. So it's quite an incredible scenery, really. It's, you know, there are high mountains, there are glaciers, there are deep valleys. And I imagine Padmasambhava, well, he might have been on his own. He might have had an attendant. There might have been several of them. But I imagine him making his way over these mountain passes. And, of course, we didn't have roads in those days. There would just be paths, and he'd be trudging along mile after mile and up and up and up from, you know, the heat and of the Indian plains up into the snowy mountains. And so the story is that he'd be going through these valleys and up these mountains, and wherever he went, he'd teach the people that he met. So wherever he met, he'd be teaching the Dharma. And also wherever he went, there'd be different wayside shrines. So there'd be a wayside shrine at the top of the pass. So you climb up the hill, top of a pass, there'd be this extraordinary view, and then you'd walk down the other side again. So at the top of a pass, there'd be a particular shrine, and a particular spirit would be guarding that pass. And perhaps the travellers would make an offering to that spirit, make an offering for their safe journey. So there are all sorts of wayside shrines. There'd be shrines in the valley, shrines at the top of the passes, shrines at the big trees, shrines by the springs, shrines by the lakes. It was a very animistic perspective that they had in those days. It was a shamanic country. So wherever he went, Padmasambhava taught the people, and he also meditated at these shrines. And when he meditated at the shrine, he'd sit with the spirit of the shrine and commune with that spirit. He'd talk to that spirit. And of course, that spirit would be guarding that place. And that spirit might have been there for a very long time, perhaps for hundreds of years or something like that. So Padmasambhava talks to the spirit, communes with the spirit. And, well, our text says, rather wrathfully, Padmasambhava subdued the spirits. Padmasambhava subdued the local gods, spirits, and demons. So that's how the text talks about it. And Padmasambhava also has this thing called a kila, or a demon dagger, or a purba. So he often pins the demon down, pins the spirit down. with his dagger. So whilst he's meditating on it, he's paying it attention, paying it close attention. And there's this dialogue, this involvement, this interaction between him and the spirit. So there's this sense of transformation that he engages with, transforms the spirit, and turns the spirit into a Dharma protector. So Padmasambhava established all of these Dharma protectors all the way around the Tibet. And at each of these places, he'd also place a treasure. Quite what this treasure would be very varied. So some of the treasures are sacred texts, some of the treasures are implements, such as vajras or double vajras or kilas, whatever ritual implements or possessions he had. And at each of these sacred places, he'd plant a treasure. And of course, later on, and this is a whole other part of the story, later on, people would find these treasures and read these texts that he'd placed at these different places and discover all of these teachings. And in that way, well, the whole teaching of Padmasambhava spread. But that's a whole other story. So here we have it, Padmasambhava at the wayside shrines, making his way to Lhasa to establish Same Monastery. And when he gets to Lhasa, he's met by the king. And he's met by the king, and the courtiers, and the queen is there. And Padmasambhava, having travelled there for weeks, he's muddied, he's dirty, he's got his robe wrapped around him, it's cold, and he's standing there meeting the king and the queen with all his courtiers. And of course, in terms of the etiquette of the day, the issue is, and this is a very important issue, who is going to bow to who? Who is going to bow to who? So Trisun Detson has invited Padmasambhava. So Trisun Detson thinks, I am the king. Padma should bow to me. But Padma thinks, I've come all this way. I'm not going to bow to the king. I am a great tantric master. I am master of three yanas. I'm not going to bow to him. And he sort of gazes at the king and gives the king this vajra gaze. And the king, the queen, the courtiers all prostrate themselves. They can't resist his gaze. And Padmasambhava is standing there. Standing there. He's just standing there. And everybody has prostrated himself. So that's the power of the guru. So a dramatic entrance from Padmasambhava. So that's the story. Anyway, they build the monastery, they translate the texts, they ordain the monks, they teach the laity, they gradually establish Buddhism. And Padmasambhava stays there, perhaps for weeks, for months, for years. We don't really know how long he stays there. But there's no record of him leaving. That's the interesting thing. So there's no record of the historical Padmasambhava leaving. So we don't really know how long he lived. So the question is, well, what does all this mean? What is this story really getting at? And what is the relevance for us today? And there's a couple of things that I would like to draw out. So particularly the difference between Shantarakshita, who is the scholar, and Padmasambhava, who is the tantric master. So King Trisun Detson invites Shantarakshita, who is a very famous, he's very notable, he's a very worthy scholar, but in a way, translating the text practicing ethics and scholarship, the monasticism, just simply wasn't enough. It wasn't really enough to, if you like, engage the Tibetan psyche. It wasn't really enough to engage those people, really. The psychic depths were not really transformed. They weren't really involved. So Padmasambhava was able to do that. He was a master of transformation. He spoke not only in terms of concepts, but also in terms of images, in terms of symbols, and in terms of magical transformation. So really that's what was needed to establish Buddhism in Tibet. To speak, in a way, not just the language of reason and concept, but also symbol and image. So symbols and images are very important because they speak to our depths and they engage our depths. So all this is important for us here in Shrewsbury. Well, we need the Dharma communicated intelligently and clearly, and we need models and maps and methods, so we need to be able to understand the Dharma conceptually, and all that's very important. We need to engage our conscious rational minds, as that's very important. But also, well, we need something more than that as well. We need to engage our imaginations, and we need symbols that will speak to us, symbols that will speak to our hearts and also to our depths. So I want to talk a bit about this idea of Padmasambhava converting the demons. So what happens when we meditate? Is it all completely easy and all completely straightforward, and you just plunge into some deep samadhi, deep meditation? Or what happens? What happens? What do you actually need? What actually happens? What do you find? I mean,
it might be like that, but fleetingly. Most of it's sort of distraction, planning. Fidgeting.
Ideas. Fidgeting. So we could say all sorts of unruly emotions. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So our emotions don't do what we'd like them to do. I mean, we have this idea, oh, I'm going to do the metta bhavana or something like that, or I'm going to practice the mindfulness of breathing. But what about our psychic depths? Have we asked them? Have we engaged them? What do they want to do? Do they really want to practice the metta bhavana or the mindfulness of breathing? Well, maybe they don't. Maybe they've got other interests. So this is really what it comes down to. So we need to speak to, communicate to the deeper parts, the deeper aspects of ourselves. So in our stories, in our mythology, all these deeper aspects of ourselves are talked about in terms of gods or spirits or demons. They're embodied, they're alive, and they are alive in our meditation, aren't they? There are all these different parts of ourselves with different qualities. And we need to engage with them. And you might wonder, well, why do they come and distract my meditation? Why? I mean, most of the time they behave themselves. And then as soon as I start meditating, they all come out like a procession. They weren't there before, and they all come out and start saying, hello, I'm here, please pay attention to me. So an important teaching is what I call the return of the unresolved. The return of the unresolved. So if we don't resolve our emotions on a deep emotional level, or on a deep unconscious level, then whatever is unresolved just keeps on coming back. So whatever is unresolved just keeps on coming back. And of course, our meditation is a wonderful time for whatever is unresolved to keep on coming back. So when our unruly emotions do come back and start troubling us in our meditation, well, the last thing we should do is push them away and try to carry on with our meditation and keep them at bay. In a way, what we need to do is say hello to them. Say hello and welcome them and say, glad you're here. And anyway, we can be glad that they're here because they're giving us this opportunity to resolve them. So that's absolutely wonderful. Every meditation you have is an opportunity to resolve your deepest, darkest, most unruly fears and emotions and distractions. What a wonderful thing that we have this opportunity. So we can reframe our meditation in this way. I mean, maybe we can proceed with the metta bhavana or mindfulness of breathing. Sometimes we can, but other times we just need to pay attention to exactly what's happening and to come more fully and deeply in relationship with these various unruly feelings and emotions and distractions. So that's what it means when Padmasambhava's transforming the demons. What we need to do is pay attention to these unruly emotions, bring awareness to them. And if we pay them attention, if we bring awareness to them, then that opens the possibility of transformation. Paying attention, in a way, two different things need to be avoided. There's pushing them away. That doesn't really help. That won't get us anywhere, because if we push them out the back door, they'll just come in through the window. We can't keep them at bay. That's the whole principle about the return of the unresolved. So we need to pay them attention. You can't push them away, but on the other hand, we shouldn't identify with them either. So it's about creating a space of awareness where we can really experience what's going on, really come into relationship with what's going on, but without either identifying it or pushing it away. So that's the kind of emotional transformation that Padmasambhava is engaged with, and that's how he managed to subdue the gods, spirits and demons of Tibet and convert the whole country and establish the Dharma just simply through paying them attention, not pushing them away, not identifying with, but coming into a deep and profound relationship with them. So I think this is how I understand the myth, the relevance of the myth of Padmasambhava transforming the demons, that we all have our own unruly emotions and distractions. And, well, we need to pay them attention. We need to bring awareness. So this is, in a way, what Padmasambhava's teaching and what he can embody for us, this potential for deep transformation. And we can ask ourselves, and this is the question for this next meditation, you can ask yourself, well, what are you working with? What are you working with? What are the issues that need to be worked with? And how can you work with those? And whatever arises, well, the invitation is just to bring awareness to it, without pushing it away, without identifying with it, and being present with the feeling content of whatever is there. So the feelings, the emotions, well, we need to find some deeper resolution of them. And Padmasambhava can help us. There's the example of Padmasambhava that we have, and we can call on Padmasambhava He can be an exemplar in this process of deep transformation. So we can call on him, we can recite his mantra, and whenever we feel most up against it in our life, that's the time to call on Padmasambhava. Padmasambhava really is the master of deep transformation. He's most interested in your deepest, darkest, worst fears. Not the fair-weather stuff. We leave that to the Buddha. Padmasambhava likes the deeper, darker stuff, the more unruly stuff. In a way, the more dreadful, the better. That's where he begins to show interest there. So call on Padmasambhava. Yeah. So, yes, I'm running out of things to say. I think that's it. Questions on that?
I just make something a bit more clearer for myself. When you're talking about bringing the worst, deepest things and looking at them a bit closer,
yeah,
are you creating a safe place?
I think that's the awareness that does that. Yeah, it's the intention to meditate and the intention to deciding to have a look at whatever's there or to be open to whatever's there. Yeah.
So it's a safe place, so you're not getting drawn into them.
Yeah, it's definitely intention that one needs. And then the awareness itself prevents us from getting too caught up or too identified with whatever is there. Mm. So we just have a little look at what's there and see if we can enter into the feeling of whatever is there to whatever extent so that we can begin to transform it and resolve it. But I must say, it isn't quick, it isn't easy. It takes as long as it does. How long does it take? Can anybody say how long it takes to engage, to transform these aspects? Well, it isn't just simply a meditation. It's something that we're working with over many years, over a long time. But staying with it definitely helps, and we can definitely make progress if we can bring awareness to whatever is there and enter into the feeling of it.